Welcome back to the FKT Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today, I'm joined by Aaron Tun, who set the unsupported FKT for the nearly 23,000-foot peak Aconcagua. She completed the round-trip summit bid from Plaza de Mulas in just over 6.5 hours. Aaron, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I'm really excited to chat with you about what you've been up to.
Thanks for having me on, Heather. I'm excited to chat more.
So I know I originally reached out to you about your FKT on Aconcagua, but then when I was researching it, I saw you've had an extremely busy winter in South America in general. You've climbed a bunch of high altitude peaks there, Chimborazo, Corazon, Cotopaxi, and more. So I think the first question I have is, what were your goals? Why were you in South America climbing all these high peaks? And how did Aconcagua fit into this?
Aconcagua was my main objective when going down to South America. But since it's their summer when it's winter in the States, I figured it'd be good to tack on a couple extra months before. And those would act as acclimation leading up to Aconcagua. For those who don't know, Aconcagua is the highest peak in South America, and it sits at just shy of 7,000 meters or 23,000 feet in elevation. I'm from Colorado, so I'm pretty acclimated already, but obviously there's a huge jump in going from like 14ers all the way up to almost 23,000 feet. So Ecuador is actually a great place to acclimate and train for bigger objectives because it has great access to high altitude peaks like Cotopaxi, Chimborazo, Cayambe. There's 10 peaks in Ecuador that are over 5,000 meters. So it's a great stepping ground for Aconcagua.
And I noticed that you actually stayed after Aconcagua and did a bunch more peaks. Was that just for fun, like you couldn't get enough, or did you extend your trip, or were you planning already to hang out longer?
I did extend my trip. A lot of my travels are very spontaneous, so I didn't have a return flight booked, but I had been wanting to go after the Cotopaxi record as well while I was down there, and I actually attempted it a couple times prior to leaving before Aconcagua and just got caught in some snowstorms, and conditions were not great for running fast on Cotopaxi. So that's why after Aconcagua, I went back to Ecuador, super acclimated for Cotopaxi, because Cotopaxi is like 19,000 feet and fortunately had better weather conditions. So was able to give that one another go. I also had a couple friends in Ecuador at the time. My partner, Chris Fisher, I think you've had on the podcast as well, for his Colorado Winter 14ers. He was there, and our good friend, Tyler Andrews, his home base is kind of Quito, Ecuador. So yeah.
I could probably talk to you for like a long time about this because this is sort of, I'm not interested in FKTs, but this is sort of like what I'd like to do next winter. So with the goal of soloing Aconcagua. So, but aside from that.
Yeah, reach out, let me know.
Yeah, I'd love to like chat with you a little bit more about this. So obviously you're climbing these big peaks and then you're acclimatizing. Can you talk about what you're doing in between? Because obviously you're not climbing a big mountain every single day, I assume. How are you kind of maintaining that altitude training, but getting adequate rest and moving back and forth between these peaks? How close are they to each other? What is that actually looking like on the ground?
Yeah, it's a lot of moving around. When I first got to South America, Chris and I, we spent about 6 weeks living in an apartment in Quito. And Quito sits up at like 9,000 feet in elevation. So just sleeping there, you're getting good acclimation. And then the backyard peak above Quito is called Ruku Pinchicha. And that goes up to, I think it was like close to 15,000 feet. So yeah, like you get 6,000 feet of vertical relief right from the city of Quito. So I think I climbed Ruku like 13, 14 times while I was there.
You can do it blindfolded at this point.
I know every rock. It got the local legend status. So yeah, that was great to kind of like hunker down and train and get into a routine of things. I was also using like sauna every night for 30 minutes to an hour, which I think helped with the red blood cell production. And then, yeah, when after about 6 weeks, I flew down to Mendoza, and Chris went off on his Ecuador bikepacking project. And then, yeah, we reconvened a couple weeks later back in Ecuador to climb some more peaks.
And so I have a couple of spinoff questions on that. So obviously you're doing this local peak a bunch of times. I assume that means you're just going up there on your own. Did you feel safe? Are there any issues with doing hiking in Ecuador or elsewhere solo? I know like your Aconcagua FKT was unsupported, but I know things like Chimborazo and Cotopaxi, like they require you to have guides. Can you just talk a little bit about the safety, the permitting, logistics? Because to me, that seems like that would be a huge thing, especially in another country, about like figuring all of that out.
Sure. Yeah. Quito, like any other major city, it has its parts that you probably shouldn't go to by yourself, you know, with a lot of nice clothing and gear and equipment on you. But like, for the most part, like I felt very safe in Quito. If you go to like the coast, it has like regions that are more dangerous as a tourist. But like in the city, in the mountains, in the jungle, like very nice, very friendly people.
Oh, yeah. So that safety was one aspect. And then also just the permitting and doing things unsupported versus supported, like with and without guides. How did that look? Obviously, each of these mountains is different, but how'd you go about that?
For Cotopaxi and Chimborazo, since those are at a higher altitude, I was joined with climbing partners, Chris. There can be crevasses, so like it is safer to have people with you on those. As far as the guides go on the 5,000 meter peaks in Ecuador, you can climb those, but you do have to apply for independent permits. So you can climb them without a guide. That is possible.
Is that pretty time consuming? Like, did you have to do that far in advance or did you just do it once you guys were already in country?
We were able to do that once we were all there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And then with Aconcagua, was it similar? Were you able to just get a solo permit or did you do a hybrid permit with guides that helped you to base camp? How did you end up handling the permitting for Aconcagua?
Yeah. So for Aconcagua, I went through an expedition company called Grijales. It's the same expedition company that Tyler used when he was going after his Aconcagua records. And so they were informed of like what my goals and intentions were when going there. And they knew that I wanted to go for a fast effort and do it solo. But all additional services like camping and food, they were still able to provide for me. So like on the trek up there and out of there, I was able to stay in their domes and tents. And then while I was at Plaza de Mulas Base Camp, they cooked for me. They had a tent for me. So that was all taken care of. But then as far as like, yeah, running from there to the summit and back down, that was all solo.
That seems like a really nice thing to not have to think about those aspects when you're going up a huge mountain. Just be like, okay, all I have to do is get to the top and get back here and then somebody's going to like feed me.
For sure. Yeah, no, and they cook like great food too. So it certainly made life a lot less stressful for me. And I could be just, you know, focused on the goal at hand of, you know, familiarizing with myself with the route, scouting it and trying to get up and down it as efficiently as possible.
Yeah. And so how long did you hang out at Plaza de Mulas? Like, were you just like, you went in and you felt acclimatized and you were just there and you went up the next day? Did you have to wait for weather? Like, how long were you on the mountain?
I think I was up at base camp for about a week and I did have to wait a couple days for a good weather window. There had been some recent snow. I use meteorologist named Chris Tomer. He's a good friend and he specializes in high altitude forecasting. And he actually works with a lot of the expedition companies up there anyway. So yeah, I would text him like every day and he would give me a forecast a couple days out, you know, like recommending which days look ideal for a record.
That's a great friend to have.
Yeah, no, he's awesome. I've used him for a lot of FKT projects in the past as well. But I did go up on a few like scouting missions up to like Camp 2 and a little bit above. I think I went up there 2 or 3 times prior to the record. And originally I was thinking that I would summit once beforehand, before going for speed, just to learn the route. But I was talking with Tyler about it and he advised against that just because of the drain and the fatigue it would place on your body. So I'm glad I didn't do it once entirely beforehand, because I don't think my body would have been able to recover at those altitudes like fast enough for me to be ready for that weather window.
Right. Yeah. I feel like, you know, even if you're going, you know, slowly and not like pushing the pace, that still takes a huge toll on your body once you get up that high.
Definitely. Yeah. And base camp sits at about 14,000 feet. So yeah, it's really hard for your body to recover when you're sleeping at that altitude.
Right. It's like camping out on the summit of Elbert and expecting to recover.
Yeah.
So kind of a little bit more about training and recovery and that sort of thing. Do you have special tools like oxygen meters or anything like that to monitor yourself when you're on the mountain and kind of just know when you're recovered or when you're stressed and gauge how that's going?
I had my like Coros watch with me and I'd keep an eye out at like my heart rate. I'm not the type of person who like focuses too intently on the numbers. Yeah, I feel like I've developed a pretty like intuitive sense of my body over the couple years, and I know what it feels like when I'm feeling like recovered and ready to go for it versus when I'm not.
Yeah, I feel like there's something to be said for that. When I climbed Kilimanjaro, the guiding service insisted that we did these checks every night where they like did our pulse and our blood pressure and all of this. And honestly, the numbers stressed me out. I felt fine. And then I feel like the night before the summit, my blood pressure was super high. And then I basically had a panic attack about it. And prior to that, I felt fine. But then I was like throwing up and having a panic attack because the numbers scared me. And it was like, if I'd just been like in my body, like maybe it would have been fine.
Yeah, exactly. It's like when you wake up feeling great and ready to go for a run and your watch tells you you're far from recovering, and you're like, oh, well, shoot, I was feeling otherwise.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So sometimes it's better.
Yeah, it is easy to get too bogged down in the numbers.
Right, for sure. So obviously we've talked a lot about the peaks you climbed, you know, in preparation for climatization and obviously getting a lot of vert in there. But can you talk about your training as a whole? How do you go about preparing to spend a winter running up, you know, 5, 6, 7,000 meter peaks? How do you prepare for that?
Yeah, no, I feel like my training is very diverse, just depending on what the objective at hand is. Training for an individual FKT, like up a 13er or 14er, is going to look very differently than like larger volume objectives. I had spent the whole summer in Colorado up in high alpine training for Nolans, which is another story. So I was feeling pretty acclimated before I went down to South America already.
And once you were there in between like the big peaks, what were you kind of doing? Obviously, when you were in keto, you were running up the same peak regularly. But what were you doing other than that? Were you resting a lot and just focusing on these bigger days? Or were you doing just easy shakeout runs every day? Like, what was kind of the in-between the peak training?
Yeah, a little bit of everything. There's a really nice park in keto called La Carolina Park. So that's where I'd go for some flatter, faster running. Obviously, running at 9,000 feet is still hard. And then a couple times a week, we'd try and go on road trips to some surrounding peaks, like Volcan Corazon, a couple trips to like Cotopaxi National Park to start touching those higher altitudes that were higher than like Ruku, Pinchicha.
In general, obviously each of these peaks is a little different. You already talked about a little bit about Cotopaxi, where you had to be roped up. But can you talk about what kind of gear you use for these high altitude FKTs, maybe at a general level and then specifically to Aconcagua?
I only brought trail runners with me down to South America. I didn't bring any mountaineering boots as well. My sponsor, Teva, they made me a custom pair of like mountain boots, trail runners combined. So they were like trail runners on the bottom, essentially, with a Gore-Tex upper gaiter. So I could still move fast and efficiently in high mountain terrain, but they kept my feet dry and warm. So I had tested those out on Cotopaxi prior to bringing them to Aconcagua. And then eventually those are the same shoes that I wore for the Aconcagua record. But I knew that they would work for me at like high altitude, like glaciated terrain.
Okay. What other types of gear do you generally use? Are you carrying ice axes? Are you carrying traction? Are you wearing a helmet? Do you have any sort of specialized gear list that you need for these peaks?
Yeah. So for Aconcagua, I didn't bring an ice axe or crampons. I did bring micro spikes with me. They're by a brand called Hillsound, and they're kind of like a Cthulhu micro spike plus a mountaineering crampon hybrid. The spikes are a little bit more beefy because there is one snowy traverse that you have to do on Aconcagua. But for the most part, it's not a very technical peak. Like aside from like the snow traverse, you definitely don't want to slide there. You could get pretty beat up, but there's no technical climbing abilities needed. And then for Cotopaxi, I did bring an ice axe and a helmet with me just because that one is like a little bit more dangerous with crevasse potential.
What were the temps like? I'm just surprised. I get cold very easily, so I'm very surprised to hear you say you just wore like a trail runner hybrid up Aconcagua, because I just think of it as being such a cold mountain. And I'm looking at when I plan to climb, renting mountaineering boots and like, do I need a down suit? So what were the temperatures like for you? I mean, maybe you were moving so fast, you were staying warm, but like, what was that like up there?
I do think the speed helps with staying warm. I did luck out with the weather I had on my short record day, because even just a few days later, I wanted to go for the longer record from the Horcones trailhead, which is like basically the road at the entrance to the park. And that one's about 40 miles round trip. I did 36 out of the 40 miles and I made it to about camp 2. And the weather was vastly different than just a few days prior. Like my fingers were frozen, my toes were frozen. It was windy, it was actively snowing on me. So
wow.
I made the decision to turn around that day, but it's all good. I feel lucky that I was able to get the short record in, and I know I'll be back for the longer one. But yeah, that's just an example of how quickly it can change up there. And yeah, after I left, I know the climbers who were still up there, they encountered like 80 plus mile per hour winds. And
wow.
I think that's like the main concern on Aconcagua is the winds.
Yeah. So how did you, obviously it sounds like you had a really great day when you summited, but like what kind of like layering and clothing choices are you making? Obviously, because if things change up there, you need to have some things with you. So like what were you carrying with you? What were you wearing?
For the most part, speed is safety. Like knowing that I can get down the mountain quickly, like if things take a turn, but in order to go fast, that means I also have to travel like much lighter and not bring as many layers. On my short record day, I brought 2 puffies that I was able to fit in my trail vest. And then I had like tights on and a pair of mountaineering pants above that. I also had some like thermic heated socks. And I left base camp that morning a little after sunrise and was freezing and had all of those layers on. And then 10 minutes up the climb up the hill, I was already overheating. So I had to like shed all those layers, and that cost like a minute or two.
Right. And you had room in your trail vest for all the layers you were taking off?
I did. It was jam packed. Yeah. Okay. It was not a light running vest.
Yeah. I just remember kind of having a similar experience on Kilimanjaro, and I had these thick insulated pants. And like by the time I was coming down the mountain, I was just so overheating because it warmed up so much from starting in the dark. And there was no room for them in my pack. So I had like literally had the legs tied around my waist like they were a jacket, and I had this big like floppy. Anyway, it was a scene. But yeah, so I was wondering when you have the big layers and then you're trying to get it into that small package.
Yeah. Yeah. No, especially because like you're gaining 8,000 feet from base camp to summit. So there's just so many varied temps. And by the time I was coming back down the mountain through the snow, the sun was just reflecting, radiating off of it. And I was so hot.
Oh, yeah.
At that point, like I felt like I could have been in shorts and a tank top and been fine.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've definitely had that when you're out on a glacier in the sun and you're just like, now I just feel like the flea on the white dog. I am just baking.
Yep.
Yeah. So we've talked a little bit about it because you mentioned this, the snow traverse, but could you just walk us through what the route on Aconcagua is like? Because I know it's non-technical, but what does it look like there? How much are you on snow? Are you on rock? Like, is there a trail? Like, what is the route actually look like?
Yeah, so there's a very well-defined route up Aconcagua from base camp to the summit. The FKT route I took from base camp to camp two, it varies a little bit in that it's essentially just like the straightest line up to camp two versus normally you kind of wrap around and hug like the ridge a little bit to get to camp one and then traverse over. I kind of chopped all that and just went like straight up the scree, which is what similar, but just like the similar route that previous FKT holders have taken. And then from camp two to the summit, you kind of wrap around and hug the ridgeline. In my scouting missions, I had tried chopping that as well and traversing from like camp two, just like straight up to kind of the snow traverse. But that whole section was covered in snow for me while I was there. So it ended up not being the most efficient. And that's why I decided once I got to camp two, I was going to stay on the standard route to the summit. But then for the descent, I did take the snow kind of shortcut down. And it really just depends on when you're there and what conditions are looking like. I believe when Tyler did his record, everything that was covered in snow for me was dry for him. And it's actually really good scree underneath, that type that you can just like get down in a couple minutes. So with that being said, I do believe there's still more time to be shaved off.
Right. Yeah. What do you consider that you were there early season, mid season? When in the climb season do you feel like you were there?
I think I was there about mid season.
Mm-hmm. So earlier season conditions, maybe more snow, later season, probably more scree.
Yeah. Although I am glad I didn't attempt it later on in the season, just because that's like I said, that's when the weather really and the winds especially picked up and became more, yeah, not suitable for a record attempt.
Yeah, it's like that kind of balance between, you know, snowpack and weather, because those things kind of all play into each other, and trying to find the balance of not having it be too snowy but also not being too windy. And you know, and I'm sure that varies from year to year.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, yeah, there's an element of luck involved with these high mountain speed efforts, I've learned. Like, you can feel like you're ready both mentally and physically, but then, you know, if the weather doesn't align, if the conditions don't align, like, it's not going to happen. So it's like a puzzle, you know, and all the pieces have to fit together in order for it to happen.
Obviously, there's lots of people on Aconcagua all the time, but when you were actually going for the summit, were there a lot of people on the route? Were you encountering other climbers, or were you pretty much by yourself?
I was entirely by myself from base camp to camp two. Yeah, most people, they like break it up and they spend a few days climbing the mountain, obviously, to acclimate. So yeah, that was a really like quiet and peaceful morning up to camp two. And then I encountered a few guided parties when I reached the snow traverse section. So for the most part, they either like stepped aside for me or I was able to scoot around them.
Mm-hmm. And how about the summit? Were there a lot of people on the summit when you got there?
There were. Yeah, I spent like a whole, I think, 5+ minutes up there, just, yeah, soaking it in, taking pictures. And again, that's more time to be shaved off. But since it was my first time up at Aconcagua, I really wanted to, like, you know, soak in the views and actually appreciate it.
Yeah, especially if you've got the weather for it. I've talked to a few people who had terrible weather, so they just got there, turned around, headed straight back down. No chance to look around.
Yeah.
I kind of was wondering about the people, because it just seems to me like if you're up on, you know, the highest peak in the Americas and you're all alone, that seems like it would feel some kind of way. But it sounds like there were people around, so we never really had that like completely isolated moment on the mountain.
Yeah, no, there were a handful of very curious people, you know, a lot of people wearing like the big puffy, like almost like 8,000 meter suits. And then here comes a girl trail running and just like some light clothes and trail runners.
Right. Did you get anybody who was critical of what you were doing? Like, oh, you're being so irresponsible being up here like that?
Not in the moment. Yeah, everybody like at my expedition camp, like they were awesome. Like they were cheering me on and rooting for me. And by the time I came running back down to camp, they were there clapping for me. So yeah, the energy was awesome. After the fact, after I posted about it, there were a handful of comments, you know, saying that I should slow down and stop at Smell the Roses, and which, you know, I've received that commentary before on like other FKTs, and like I understand where it's coming from. I just think like I have a like different perspective when it comes to like the mountains and like how I enjoy the mountains. And I think like oftentimes people don't see like I'm not just like sprinting up and down these mountains first try. Like it's a long process of, you know, like learning the routes and oftentimes rehearsing them multiple times. And like that's my opportunity to like do them slow and like take in the scenery. But I love the challenge of it and pushing like my body and mind and seeing what they're capable of. And yeah, I think everybody should be able to appreciate the mountains, like how they choose. And whether you're like going for a speed record or just climbing Aconcagua, both of them are awesome.
That kind of plays a little bit into my last question, which is in the mountaineering world, like high altitude mountaineering especially, there's not a ton of women doing it. And there's certainly even less women that are going unsupported, fast and light, FKT style. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about what motivates you. Like, obviously, you were just kind of touching on that a little bit about how you enjoy the mountains. But what motivates you to do this? How did you get into this? Like, what brought you to this point where you're solo, unsupported, FKTing Aconcagua? Like, what's that journey been like?
Yeah, if you had told me, like, 5-6 years ago that this is where I would be at, I wouldn't have believed you. I graduated college in 2020 and moved home to Colorado, thought I was going to take a gap year and go to law school, and that's what my life would look like. But in the meantime, like that summer, I made it a goal to like finish hiking all of Colorado's 14ers, not even running, just like hiking. And I'd see people like running up and down the mountains, and that's kind of when I learned what like trail running was as a sport and what FKTs were. So I kind of just like dove headfirst into that process and didn't have much of a running background. I'm all like self-taught when it comes to that area. Like I don't work with a coach. But yeah, for me, like it's more about like the exploration and the adventure and just like the curiosity of what's behind this corner. Will these ridge lines connect with each other? I wonder what that landscape looks like over there. So it's like, I think I'm competitive with myself, and that's like why FKTs are great, because like they still have that competitive element, but like it is more about the adventure. So yeah, it's kind of what drives me.
What's been, obviously you said, you know, this wasn't your plan, so what's been your big takeaway from these experiences you've had, whether it's, you know, on Aconcagua or just like the variation from your perceived life path? What's been your big takeaway from FKTs in general?
It's a big world out there, and there's lots of pockets to explore. And I feel like now, even as I'm nearing like 200 FKTs, I feel like I've only scratched the surface. And even beyond just like learning the routes and like the physical elements of them, I've also been able to immerse myself in a lot of different cultures and get to meet some incredible people all over the world. And that's one thing that I love about FKTs too. I find that there's like little to no gatekeeping. It's like if you reach out to somebody and say, hey, I'm interested in this route, I see that you've done it before. Anytime I've done that, they've been like super generous with like giving out beta and information. And I hope to do the same as well if anybody reaches out to me.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and chatting. This has been a lot of fun to talk about, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Heather. Looking forward to more conversations in the future.
Thanks again, Aaron, for coming on the show. You can read about her FKTs on the website, fastestknowntime.com, and follow her adventures on Instagram at Erin_Tun.